about your fighter pilot times, and now I'd like to make a bit of a shift that in 1960 you became a transport pilot.
Yes.
At RCAS Station Trenton, flying North Stars.
That's right.
How did that go from, I think I'm missing a few years in there, but from Sabre jets to transports?
Well, very briefly, having done my operational tour in Gotonkin, I was assigned to the Overseas Ferry Unit, which had the responsibility of flying F-86s and some T-33s from Canada, Canada's production lines, over to the Air Division. So I was involved in that for 2 years. Had ten flights across the Atlantic in a variety of airplanes, mostly Sabres. When that replenishment of airplanes to Europe ceased in 57, 58, the Overseas Ferry Unit was no longer necessary. So that organization, like a squadron, although there were just two flights, was disbanded to other tasks. One of the things that Air Transport Command had a responsibility for was overseas ferry. That is, a traditional function of air transport was to organize, manage any flights of airplanes across the Atlantic. So, knowing that there were going to be future flights from time to time, especially as the CF-100 squadrons were being brought into strength, Air Transport Command needed somebody with some experience on overseas flying to be the coordinator for future overseas ferry operations. That was my task, Staff Officer Ferry. within the operational headquarters of Air Transport Command at Lachine in Montreal. So that gave me my entree to Air Transport Command, and for close to a year, my function was principally that of advising CF-100 squadrons how to plan and conduct their operation across the water, and coordinate all of those functions within their transport command. Then I was appointed executive assistant to the commander of air transport in Lachine. And that whole organization moved in 1958 to Trenton. So I had a little over 2 years as executive assistant to the commander of air transport, and at the conclusion of that normal two and a half year tour, I was asked if I would do a tour on transport. Most of my buddies were getting their second operational tour on CF-104s, heading back to France on those airplanes. But I said yes, I enjoyed that experience, so I was posted to 426 Squadron North Stars in Trenton, and went through the normal routine of operational training and learning how to be a transport pilot.
How many fighter pilots went to transports during those few years?
Not many. there was a natural inclination amongst the individuals to stay in the field in which they started. career potential was probably going to be better if they did that in that field. I guess a number of cases there were some transfers and vice versa, transport pilots who subsequently became fighter pilots.
Now, you eventually became a brigadier general, though, so it didn't hurt you too badly to...
No, in the end it did not, and, you know, I think partly because of the variety of experiences, I became more useful in a general sense rather than being, you know, focused on one particular aspect of flying. Or
earlier you mentioned Ken Thornycroft. Did he stay in fighters?
Yes, he did for all of his operational years, which of course was perfect for preparing him for that position of deputy commander in Northern Region.
Yeah.
NORAD.
You flew 426 Squadron. You mentioned in your little biography that you flew in the Arctic, in the Congo, in Nigeria, and all points between. Did you have any experiences flying to destinations behind the Iron Curtain?
No. I did not. There were the many other transport squadron air crew who did, the 412 squadron in particular, I guess, in manning flights that were taking senior representatives of government and military to functions in the, behind the Iron Curtain. Mm-hmm. I have not been anywhere in that area myself.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about a mission to Kano, I think, in Nigeria. Tell me about that.
Yes, well, as a more qualified pilot on 426 Squadron, I guess in about my second year on 426 Squadron, we got involved in supplying United Nations support to the Congo, which required flying airplanes all the way from Canada to Italy. Pisa was the principal staging base in Italy, and then south from Pisa to Nigeria, the Congo, through Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Kano, Nigeria was the rotation location for the final crew who would take the airplane into the Congo and back to Kano. That was a long one-day trip through very strenuous flying conditions. Generally, this was in the middle of the night, flying through the intertropical weather front, which usually meant thunderstorms up to 70,000 feet and very severe rain and lightning conditions. Mm-hmm. So that detachment who was responsible for the flights to and from the Belgian Congo required rotation every 6 months or 6 weeks, I should say. Mm-hmm. I was designated the detachment commander on one occasion, and so every airplane that came south from Pisa was put into our hands. Our crew would take it south and back to Kano and then wait for the next airplane to come.
As detachment commander, did you get to fly?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was an operational crew. I was simply the captain of the crew.
Oh. What bases were you flying into in Congo, Belgian Congo?
It was Leopoldville at the time. Of course, the name has changed since then. But,
Kinshasa, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to get off the airplane, or were you interested in getting off the airplane then?
Yes, we usually did have a couple of hours and the turnaround time in Leopoldville, and it would give us a quick chance to get down to the local markets and look for souvenirs, see something of the city. It was you had some great bargains in the markets in those days, and carved wood, and mm-hmm. So I still have one of those on my at home.
Mm-hmm.
but on some of those occasions you were required to stay over because the airplane wasn't fit to fly. It had to be repaired by the engineers, and so we did have one or two overnight stays as well. on one of those occasions was as a result of an engine failure on my own airplane coming south to Leopoldville on a very stormy night. One of the four engines quit, and we had to continue on three all the way to Leopoldville and then wait until a replacement airplane came and the crew to change the engine.
So we were in Leopoldville. Was there, what was the mood in Leopoldville, or did you get a sense of any contact with any of the local population?
Not really, no. We did have contact with some of the United Nations members of the headquarters in Leopoldville, and at one stage, one of those was my former boss, Air Commodore Carpenter. We had some communication with him about the political aspects of the UN operation.
What was Air Commodore, what was the name again?
Air Commodore Fred Carpenter.
What was he doing in Leopoldville?
He was the Canadian representative on the headquarters for the United Nations forces there. They were, you know, Army and Air Force associated in attempting to establish some stability in that rebellious area.
What were you hauling in the North Star at those days?
There were a combination of troops and cargo.
Cargo in support of the Canadian troops, or the
in support of the United Nations generally, not just Canada's.
So not necessarily food or medical supplies for the Congolese.
No, I wouldn't think there was any food or medical supplies for the Congolese. It was to support the United Nations peacekeeping troops there.
Mm-hmm. A few years later, in August 1966, you started work at the Canadian Defense Liaison Staff in Washington, D.C. The Cold War was well underway then, with radar sites in northern Canada to defend us from Soviet bomber attack, and with developments in fighter aircraft and missiles. Could you describe your duties at CDLS Washington, in particular with respect to the Cold War?
As Wing Commander Air Operations, my task was to liaise with the U.S. forces with whom we dealt and to advise our own headquarters through our attaché, that is, my boss at the time was an aeronautical engineer by the name of Air Commodore Grant, Bill Grant, who whose overall responsibility was that Air Force liaison. As I say, mine was very specifically operational matters of training, of flight safety, of all those things that were concerned to us to make sure that we were on the same wavelength in terms of technology, in terms of techniques, tactics. And so in moving my information of what the U.S. Air Force was doing to the Canadian Air Force, there was that capability to maintain standards and good relationships with the U.S. Air Force. Principal job. Mm-hmm. There were other aspects of the diplomatic world that we became involved in where there was a German embassy, a German Air Force equivalent to me, where I would deal with such people, mostly in the NATO sense. Mm-hmm. Very little contact in my time with the representatives of foreign countries, or the Russian or those embassies were pretty much closed. But through our contact with NATO representatives, we kept intelligence flowing on what they considered was happening, mm-hmm. in organizational and political terms, and assessed the implications for Canada, and forwarded on that information to our own headquarters.
You mentioned that your liaison function was largely taking information from the United States and transferring it to the Canadian Air Force. Was there vice versa?
Yeah. I found that the United States Air Force were very, very grateful for the work that we were doing, and in many cases still do, in national research terms. But I guess very specifically in my area of responsibility is flight safety. We had a very effective flight safety organization in the Canadian Air Force at that time. And I suspect that that ours was more coherent, cohesive than was the U.S. Air Force. The U.S. Air Force had a variety of large organizations, each with their own separate flight safety organizations. The Army had their own flight safety organization. The Coast Guard had a flight safety organization. And there was not the same kind of integrated flight safety procedures that we had succeeded in developing in the Canadian Air Force.
And who had developed the flight safety procedures in the Canadian Air Force? Because as I understand it, flight safety was not a big priority in the Sabre days, for instance.
Oh, I beg to differ.
Okay.
It has been of a great, great priority, and a great variety of people in flight safety or with flight safety motivations are responsible for creating what we had, an organization that the Americans really admired. I suspect that one of the pioneers was Group Captain Schultz, during my time anyway, who had previously been himself a World War II fighter pilot and subsequently a test pilot who had training in the Royal Air Force test facilities in Farnborough, and he brought back that technical expertise developed there to really rejuvenate the Canadian Flight Safety Organization. And he was the kind of individual who had the personal fire to really build an organization that was dynamic. I don't think there are many others who have done as much for flight safety in Canada than Group Captain Schultz.
Hmm. The in 1966, when you or in 1966-67, you were at CDLS Washington.
Yes.
Was there discussion? What was the discussion in those days around nuclear weapons in Canada? Do you recall?
No, I wasn't very close to that. We did have in the Air Force liaison staff. We did have a wing commander who was responsible for armaments and nuclear relationships included. Those were Bismarck days, and there was nothing that I had in responsibilities in that field. There, I suspect that the nuclear relationships with the U.S. Have always been difficult, mostly because of our own political proclivities that we haven't had. even Diefenbaker, as a conservative, anybody who was really in favor of and mm-hmm. enthusiastic about nuclear weapons.
Did that come up at all at CDLS and with your American colleagues?
No, it wasn't much of a factor. No, I think to some degree Canada was almost a bit of a nuisance with the relatively small effort that we were putting into that aspect of it.
Hmm.
We continue to be that.
And today.
Today.
In July 1972, I know we're skipping ahead at a fair clip, you became base commander of Canadian Forces Base Summerside.
Yes.
In PEI. There were maritime patrol missions being flown from Summerside. Tell me about those maritime patrol missions and what they were looking for.
Well, we were looking for enemy submarines. Yeah, Russian submarines.
Mm-hmm.
The whole objective of the Canadian naval forces on the East Coast in particular, and to a small degree on the West Coast, was focused on keeping track of where Russian submarines were transiting or were stationed on a regular basis. There were a variety of systems used in the maritime surveillance program, and of course the Argus airplane was the principal airplane with which I was familiar at that time. The Neptune had been used in earlier days, and the Lancaster prior to that in ocean surveillance. So there has been a long tradition of maritime surveillance by Canadian Air Force personnel, including, by the way, Air Commodore Carpenter, who one of his first jobs was Steinmeier's out of Shearwater.
Hmm.
So it was quite a change for me with only fighter and transport background to get into that environment of maritime surveillance. And I took every opportunity I could to learn every part of it, going to the Maritime Warfare School, which at the time was commanded by Vice Admiral Nigel Brodeur.
Mm.
And keep meeting up with the same people.
Yeah.
And to learn all of the things about maritime operations, not just the aviation part of it. That's the job of the Maritime Warfare School. And so that gave me a much better perspective of how we fit in at Summerside to the entire picture. But not satisfied with that, I took one opportunity to go to sea on a naval destroyer and another opportunity to do so in a submarine. So I got all three elements. And to participate in some of the exercises that all three services held frequently.
Did the aircrew from Summerside have some successes while you were there?
Yes.
Did they find submarines?
Oh yes. Yeah, we participated equally, and that was always one of the competitions that went on within the squadrons of Maritime Air Command. One squadron attempting to prove that it was more capable in an exercise or more capable in actual operational sightings and trackings. Exercises took up most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so our own submarines would go out in an exercise, be shadowed by ships and be chased by airplanes to learn how to track mm-hmm. and first of all detect, then track, and then quotation marks kill
mm-hmm.
An enemy submarine. So it took a good deal of coordination between naval ships, naval air, helicopters, of submarines and airplanes to determine where the quotation marks enemy was and to follow through with prosecution. I wouldn't say that the Summerside air crew were any better than the Greenwood air crew were in the overall sense, but certainly when there was a successful exercise, attack, and prosecution, it was very highly celebrated. And whenever there was a good, proper enemy detection and tracking, that too was quietly celebrated, because we didn't really want to advertise too much of how effective we were.
Now, where would the Soviet submarines be that the Summerside crews were finding or looking for?
Well, we had a variety of patrols, sometimes taking us to the other side of Iceland, but for the most part it was between Iceland and Newfoundland, and down to the southern border of our area, which would then be taken over by U.S. naval surveillance airplanes. So we had a very large chunk of the ocean. But principally, I guess, we had successes off the, between Iceland and Newfoundland.
Can you remember any of them in particular?
No. I didn't personally get involved in a mission that was successful in that sense. Mm-hmm. The closest I came to it was a sighting of whales. but I was regularly out on the patrols, 14, 16 hours, and handling the airplane.
You mentioned that when you were a Sabre pilot in France, you knew that it was a very serious mission.
Yes.
Do you think
it was very serious? Exactly the same seriousness.
Exactly the same. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much there was an intelligence person at Summerside who would have briefed you or aircrew or.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We had a very sophisticated intelligence organization operating out of Maritime Command headquarters, and each base contributing to the transmission of intelligence information up to headquarters, and the divesting the overall picture down to the squadron level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then for training, I would think there would be some training component for the air crew.
Yes.
In the intelligence.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that's that I've been looking forward to, especially about your interview and the Cold War, was that from July 76 to August 77, you were the Director of International and Arms Control Policy at National Defense Headquarters in Ottawa. Arms control was a hot issue then with, I believe, SALT.
Yes.
Tell me about those, about that job, and what some of those issues were.
Well, we had, I guess the SALT Treaty was probably the most critical. We were also getting very much involved in the reduction of the threat of mines and other military equipment that could damage our relationships with other countries. They were attempting to reduce the number of mines on a negotiated basis, east and west.
Sea mines or land
mines? Land mines. And any other such equipment like napalm. Those items of warfare that were considered to be rather indiscriminate in the killing, maiming capability. So that was a large part of the preparations for peacekeeping and negotiations to improve the capability to keep the peace. I don't think that Canada played a very large role in the strategic arms limitation part of it. That was very much between the U.S. and those who were so equipped with nuclear weapons. We weren't at the time. But we did monitor all of those activities, and both in the Department of External Affairs and in National Defense.
Why? Why monitor those things?
Well, to monitor the success that was being attained in reducing strategic arms, or in monitoring the consequences of an abuse of the arms limitation.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, there's that sense of defense versus offense.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in the international affairs and arms control field, my most interesting relationship was with the Department of External Affairs. And we then had a really capable external affairs organization, people who had spent years in diplomatic missions, had a really good sense of what was happening in countries around the world. And while I was there, I noticed that the capability of the Foreign Affairs Department to stay on top of what was happening in foreign countries was being reduced, and it's one of the things that I feel that we have gone much further in than we should have, such that we are today very, very poor in being able to provide good advice to our politicians or to the military, even of what is happening in foreign countries. And you know, I contribute to some of our current government's dithering to that lack of good staff on the ground in various parts of the world being able to communicate to Ottawa what the real story is.
So when you were doing arms control or overseeing arms control or monitoring it, what specifically was your connection with external affairs?
They had a similar organization within external affairs who were involved in peacekeeping and arms control.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a DND and external affairs joint task, if you will, to advise our government on what was happening, what we should do about certain events. So the marriage of our two directorates was really very close.
Mm-hmm. Were there ex-military people in external affairs, or ex-external affairs people in the military?
There was a little bit of cross, pollination, I would say, in careers. One of my most effective arms control officers was a naval commander, John Toogood. He's no longer with us, but he had in his naval career been fairly closely involved on the intelligence side of it, and he took that motivation into the job of arms control to the extent that I think of any Canadian officer, we had an individual who was able to communicate with external affairs on a really personal level, of being able to go to a place like Vienna, attend a meeting in company with the external affairs staff, and to be able to translate the military perspective of what was being discussed so that the external affairs staff could appreciate that side of it. And likewise, he was able to provide that external affairs appreciation of the developments to the Canadian military staff in D&D. So that relationship with external affairs was very close at the time, and as I say, we were really fortunate to have still very good people in external affairs to help us. I don't think we've got it today.
What was Canada's stake in SALT, for instance? Why did we? I can imagine why we cared. Why did we send representatives to Vienna?
Yeah. Well, I think that it's not so very different from why we should be a little closer to our responsibilities within the ballistic missile defense field. while we may not have had nuclear arms personally, we have a very real need to know what is happening in that field so that we can participate with our allies in developing an agreement that is going to benefit all of the NATO countries or our own allies. Today it's not quite so much NATO, but our European or North American friends. If we don't participate, we have no capability to assist them in a consensus building scenario.
Mm-hmm. Was there consensus building in 76, 77 during those days?
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about your impression of SALT as a Canadian officer who was connected to it. Were you hopeful that SALT would be signed by both sides and make a difference?
Well, I think, yes. I think anybody who is involved in that level of potential world damage to civilization as a whole has to be enthusiastic and motivated towards resolving them peacefully.
Though
I don't think there's anything that's more sobering than to see what the damage can be for those who are affected by any weapon of mass destruction. And I guess one of the philosophies that Air Commodore Carpenter passed along to me was perhaps we, North Americans perhaps generally, Canadians particularly, are too quiet about our capabilities in operational terms. I told you that in the NATO scenario in the early 50s, we were frequently involved in demonstrating to the other side how strong we were in air power. Mass formations along one side of the border versus mass formations on the other side of the border. And that has a deterrent effect. But in today's terms, even in late 60s, in 70s, we have much more covert operations, including submarine operations, that nobody talks about. And it's very much a paper tiger until you actually prove to somebody of what that capability is.
Give me an example.
Well, I think the Russians have shown to have been a paper tiger.
In those days?
In those days, and perhaps to some extent even today. I think we see it in North Korea today in spades. The North Koreans are posturing tremendously, but have no capability. Or I suspect their capability.
Mm-hmm.
So, Air Commodore Carpenter, for example, in the role of commander of air transport, had responsibility for supplying the Arctic, which contained a variety of organizations that were part of the Cold War, listening to what the Russians were doing and transmitting data back to intelligence systems in North America. But very, very little was said to the Russians about, you know, how effective that capability was. We heard you last night talking about your next exercise. You know, if they had known that, they might have been less willing to make any ventures that would have been aggressive.
Hmm.
So, you know, when does posturing end and proof of the pudding start? His feeling was that we should have been much more evident to the Russians about, we see that ice island. We know what equipment you've got on it. Mm-hmm. How did you know that? They would have been less aggressive, I suspect. There's always the counterintelligence aspect that has to be considered, though, and how far do you go in revealing your last ace in the hole?
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes of tape left. There's one view of history is that the Soviets were not even potentially aggressive. You mentioned the word paper tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if anything, a lot of what they were doing was reaction to things like large formations of fighters in West Germany.
Yes. Yes.
And that maybe we had that the two views, or our view of the Cold War, might have been incorrect.
That's entirely possible that we built up a threat that didn't exist. But that, I suppose, has been the result of lessons learned in World War. Post-World War I and post-World War II, we so frequently have been caught off guard for not having reacted to intelligence that most books now identify that we should have been aware of. The build-up of the German Air Force in Russia, thanks to lend-lease, if you will, between Russia and Germany. That intelligence wasn't getting through to people in England and in France. They weren't ready for what the Germans had built up or they didn't convince the politicians at the time, although there were many who tried. I think Churchill was one of them.
Mm-hmm. The Cold War studies are you may be interested to know, it's really moving along.
Yes.
As far as there's a lot of scholarship going on in Cold War studies and in identifying some of those landmarks.
Mm-hmm.
You went on to be deputy commander of a NORAD unit, so you were fully a part of that.
Yes.
Command structure.
Mm-hmm. And in the early development stages of the airborne warning and control system, which I endorsed wholeheartedly and was able to fly a couple of missions on.
So this is AWACS?
AWACS, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you were involved in the AWACS, early AWACS?
Certainly. All of the regions were involved in the coordination of AWACS controls. But I was particularly interested in the airborne part of it and went to Oklahoma to get a couple of missions and understand how it operated and mm-hmm. what it was they could see and control from the air. And it's become, I'm sure it has become far more sophisticated than ever.
Mm-hmm. These were, well, we're going to run out of tape today. And my last question, would you like to do another interview? Would you be willing to do another interview?
Yes, certainly. If there are aspects of that that you want to pursue, I have some viewpoints on where we should go in the future,
yes.
In surveillance, for example.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for today's interview.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we'll set up a next one.
Thank you, Peter.